If you have your Bible, turn with me, if you would, to Luke chapter 15. And as you will probably recall, Luke chapter 15 is host to three parables of lostness, but one that sticks out in everyone's mind, and that is the parable of the prodigal son. Let me just say, it looks like we're kind of running a skeleton crew here today. I'm going to take advantage of the discuss with the person next to you dynamic so we can talk about some of these things because there's a lot of interesting little nuggets in this passage that I think a lot of us pass over, and it's very unlikely that you'll discover them just sitting there by yourself doing it. You need a multitude of perspectives. So if you see that there is literally no one around you, move to where there is someone close to you. Anyways, with that said, Luke 15, verse 11, follow along with me if you have your text. And he, being Jesus, said, "There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living. And when he had spent everything, a severe famine arose in that country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields, to feed pigs. And he was longing to be fed with the pods that the pigs ate, and no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? I will arise and go to my father. And I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants.'" Verse 20, "And he arose and came to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and felt compassion and ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Bring quickly the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate. Now his older son was in the field, and as he came and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, 'Your brother has come, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has received him back safe and sound.' But he was angry and refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him, but he answered his father, 'Look, these many years I have served you, and I never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours came, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him.' And he said to him, 'Son, you are always with me, and all that is mine is yours. It was fitting to celebrate and be glad, for this your brother was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.'" So, fantastic parable, very well known, coming in the context here on the tail end of two other parables about lostness, right? So you have the lost sheep, and then you have the lost coin, and then you have the lost son. And we're going to circle back around to this at the end, but notice that the lostness in the last parable is very different. Because unlike the other ones, where you have a sheep lost or a coin lost, the lost person comes back this time, right? It's not like he's directionally confused, right? He comes out. So we're going to talk about that because that's provocative. There's something important there. Well, let me start out by saying that the parable of the prodigal son, as the third of, again, two increasing importance parables of lostness, is mistitled for two reasons. Number one, it's the story of the prodigal son. Does anyone know what the word prodigal means?
It doesn't mean lost. It means you been through it.
Yes. Yeah. So a prodigal, you always hear it in context the wrong way. People talk about someone who went off and lived a licentious, debaucherous lifestyle and disobeyed and then has come back, and people will say, what, the prodigal has returned or something, right? Prodigal doesn't mean that. Prodigal means excessive spending. Prodigal means that you are wastefully consuming. And the reason that it's a mislabeling of the parable is because that's not the main problem in the parable, that he just didn't manage his money well and squandered wealth. Okay, it's not a parable about money management. Okay, so I think the prodigal son is a bit of a misnomer here. Well, what about the second thing? The fact that, is the parable really about just one son? No. The parable is about two sons, a younger brother and an older brother. And both of them are very, very, very important. And Jesus put the second son in there, not so that we would cut our memory of this parable off at verse 24, but so that we would take a peek at the older brother and understand how we can see ourselves in him. Okay, I'm going to try this again. Okay, so I want to go through this, and I want to do what I'm just calling discussion and discovery. So again, if you're hopefully that you're around somebody that you can talk about this with, because some of this stuff is just so, so fascinating and is profound in terms of how we understand this parable. So the son's request first is one thing that I think would be very important to understand. So in verse 12, Luke tells us through the words of Jesus that, there was a man who had two sons, verse 12, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of the property that is coming to me, and he divided his property between them. Okay? So I want you to talk. I'll give you 5 minutes. I want you to talk. What are a couple of reasons that this request is so audacious? Okay? There are a couple of different reasons that this request is so audacious. Get with someone right around next to you. Talk about, why is this request, divide up your property, or give me the share of property that's coming to me, and he divided his property between them. Why would the people listening to this story gasp? Go. Okay. I want to hear from the groups. I'm very eager to see what people have discerned in here, because it's always so fascinating getting such a multitude of perspectives and harvesting the wisdom of collective interpretation. I'm trying to manage my time here because there's like four or five questions that I want to talk about. So if I cut somebody off and you just had to share, let me know if it's breaking your heart. Otherwise, we'll get a couple people then move on. Okay. So who wants to, yes, Ben.
Are we doing microphones or just?
Oh, I assume so. I apologize. I didn't. Josh was at the ready, so I just thought he was going to run over there.
So one of the things that I think is important is it's not like he's got a bank account with all of his funds in there, okay, and he's just going to go down to the bank and cut his son a check for,
right,
you know, okay, a portion, whatever his portion is. He's got to go liquidate his assets in order to be able to do that, which makes this a very communal dishonor.
Can you explain what it means to liquidate your assets?
So, okay. So it means he's going to have to sell off fields. He's going to have to sell off, you know, animals or whatever it is in order to get a third of what, or however, I shouldn't say a third, whatever. So if he had two sons, it would be a third because the firstborn would get twice as much. But this would be very communal.
Yeah.
It would be exposing this dishonor to the whole community.
Absolutely. So, fantastic point. So, I couldn't have said any better. There wasn't a bank account. He didn't just have this big treasure chest in his bedroom, right? When the son asked for his portion of the property, which would be, to his point, a third, because that's what the younger son would get, the older son would get the double portion, just how it went. Sorry, younger siblings. But he had to go sell off property. He had to sell off land. And when you sell off something in a community like that, doesn't everyone know about it? I mean, you're not going to sell to people who don't live in the community. This isn't like where you buy, like, for a potential timeshare in the future, you sell it to someone in Syria. I mean, you're going to sell it to someone in the community. So why are you selling off your land? Why are you selling off your property? And then you're going to have to explain your situation to people. Fantastic point. What else? Ben?
When he asks for this, for his share of the land, he's also saying to his father that, you know, you're my father and all, but what I'm really interested in is what you have to give to me. Mm. And it's unsaid that, you know, he'd be fine if his father passed away so he could get the stuff, because he's more concerned about the material part of it than whether his father still lives or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. So this is, one commentator says that this request is tantamount to saying, Dad, I care about your stuff, but not you, and you might as well just, if you could go ahead and die so I could get my cut and get out of here, that would be great. And that, especially in this culture, there are a few things that could be more shameful than a son going to his parents and saying something like that. Okay? Maybe one more.
He was broken.
He was broken when he returned. I mean, he had just been humbled, humiliated. You know, he was flat.
Hey, Sandy, could you use the microphone
now? Oh, I'm sorry. just that he was pretty devastated and flattened and broken when he returned to his father.
Oh, when he returned. Okay, yeah, absolutely. He sure was. So let me just, so those are, that is, those are the fantastic answers. Let me just point out a few more things. Maybe I can just ask this to everyone. How long did you, when you owned land in Israel, how long did you keep it?
Forever.
Forever. Right? You didn't move over to the other side of town and, you know, like we do now. When you, so someone to give up their land, that's a huge deal. That's a huge deal to sell off your land. Of course, that's why it would only happen when you were actually dead. Now, you missed something in the English translation here. Look at verse 12 with me, if you would. The younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me. The original language there, the Greek says, is ousia. It's a standard word for property. But listen to what Luke says his father gave him. He says he divided up the property, but he uses a different word. Same in the English, different in the Greek. So in verse at the 12b, where it says, and he, his father, divided his property between them. That word is bios. Yeah, what word do you hear there? Life. So the son asked for property, ousia. Father gave his bios. Just the idea that this is not merely just a piece of land. This is something so much more. This is something so much deep that this son is asking for. And that this father shockingly gives. And if someone would have asked that in that culture regularly, you would have shamed them and then disinherited them if your son had said something like that to you. It would be done. It would be equivalent now of, all right, I'm writing you out of the will. People make that joke a lot when their kids misbehave. But that's what would have happened here. He would have been disinherited and perhaps publicly shamed. So those are just a couple of the reasons the younger brother's request is so audacious. Now, verse 13 is where we get the prodigal part. So the not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had, took a journey into a far country, and there he squandered his property on reckless living. And then all of a sudden, it's very interesting how it happens, because it's not like he had money when the famine happened. You notice how Jesus puts this parable together? It's like it goes from bad to worse. It's not like he had enough money to get through the famine, right? He spent his money, then the famine comes. And then he ends up hiring himself out. And look, he couldn't even get paid. And no one gave him anything. Because notice, his primary concern here is food, isn't it? Because when he says he was in need because of a famine, if you have a house to live in and there's a famine, you still need something to eat. His primary concern here was food. But he says, look, I go to hire myself out to the citizens of that country. They send me to the field and they don't even give me anything. So it goes from bad to worse. Now, why is it, to the audience listening, why is it particularly awful that he's going into the field to feed pigs?
Because the pigs were like the lowest of the low in Israel.
Okay, so pigs, yeah, exactly. Pigs were unclean animals, right? So pigs were unclean. It wasn't this just, there was the physical nastiness of it, like, ooh, mud, ooh, pig slops. It was, I'm going to go take care of unclean animals and defile myself for a living. That's what I'm going to go do. Man, what a slide from where he was, right? And that's where we see verse 17. It's the second question that I'd like to discuss. Verse 17, but when he came to himself, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have more than enough bread, but I perish here with hunger? Here's a question I want you to discuss, same group of folks. Why do you think he finally came to his senses? And what can we learn about change from it? Why do you think he finally came to his senses? And what might we be able to learn about change from it? Go. All right. So let me just say, it goes without saying that the text does not explicitly tell us the answer to this question, which is why it makes for a provocative discussion question. But I think we can gather a couple of things from it, which is why I wanted to discuss it. So let me hear from a couple of the groups. Why do you think he finally came to his senses, and what can we learn about change from it? I want to share. What y'all talk about?
Part of what we were saying is that it's like he has now been immersed in this world where, and one thing that I didn't even notice, it says he longed to eat from what the pigs were eating, but nobody would give him anything. It's like, I'm not even going to give you what the pigs eat.
Right.
And so seeing that contrast now, being able to look back at his father's house that he didn't appreciate at all apparently before, just give me everything and I'm going to leave. He's like, wow, they, in my father's house, even the slaves were treated well. Even the lowest was treated well. And I'm at the lowest now, and I have nothing. I'd rather be a slave in that house, you know, be the lowest in that house. So it's like seeing the, being immersed in one community now that he left his father's house for, and seeing that stark contrast.
Yeah, you think you could sum that up in perspective?
Yeah.
Understanding the larger picture? Yeah, I sometimes in our grief, very legitimate and illegitimate pain, suffering, sometimes our whole world can shrink down to the size of our pain. And when that happens, we lose perspective. But the opposite happens here in this story, where this person has very little perspective or very little appreciation for what he has in his father's house, and it takes him going out to see, wow, look how far I've fallen, what have I done? And all of a sudden he gets like this 10,000-foot view of reality here, this map. He gets perspective, and he understands. Good. What else? What else did he finally come to his senses? Was this hard, or did no one talk about it? Both.
He doesn't mention, it doesn't mention his feelings toward his father, whether that changed.
That's right.
At all. And I thought that was interesting.
Very great point. So he doesn't say, oh man, you know what, I really hurt Pop.
Yeah.
I need to go back and do this. He says, look how what is he particularly? He's hungry, right? Okay. So he's hungry, and that is at least, that is the primary, it looks like, motivating factor, or at least one of the primary motivating factors for him to go home. So I'm hungry, number one, and I have means, but it's just over there. Those are the two things that seem to kind of come together to form the plan. And here's something that I think we can learn about change from that. Again, sometimes, so when he's hurting, can you feel the hunger pains even in his stomach? Wanting to eat food that the pigs eat, but no one will even give him anything. And this, he is clearly, and where's the word here? But I perish here. That's the word that he uses. He is in anguish. He's not just like slightly, you know, I'm going to fast a meal or something. He is in anguish, but I perish here with hunger. This is an extreme hunger, and it's the idea that sometimes you have to feel hurt You have to help somebody, or you yourself have to feel hurt and feel your pain before you will be sufficiently motivated to move forward. Now that sounds kind of, that sounds maybe sadistic or mean, but I have found over and over and over that people who do things to mask pain in their life, to mask hurt, never ever feel sufficient compulsion to move forward. And so sometimes, in fact, there was a small group leader in Navigators when I was in college at the University of Alabama. His name was Matt Letourneau. He would pray for people in his group to have pain and suffering. And he explained this to me. Now, I didn't sign up for his small group. I'll be honest with you. I didn't. But, you know, if you have a burn on your arm, and those of you who have been burned, I assume most people have at least some point in life to some degree, you know, and when you take that ice pack off when it's fresh, I mean, you think you're going to reach that moment where it's like stings and then stops, and it just seems to keep going, right? Does everyone know what I'm talking about? It just keeps going and going. Like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And the idea is, if you somehow got a cream and put it on there, it didn't fix the hurt at all, didn't fix the burn at all, but it stopped it from hurting like that, then all of a sudden would you be so motivated to go to the doctor and get it fixed and go to extreme measures? No. I mean, it's just, you know, it's a little bit inconvenient, but I can live with it. I'm doing fine. It's not all that bad. That's what happens when people don't take some time to actually experience their own pain and hurt. And sometimes as loving people and loving friends, we can help people do that with wise questions. You have to do that very carefully. But sometimes feeling and experiencing pain is what drives us back into change. So what's his plan here? What's the plan here? Well, what he says is, you know, I'm going to be a hired servant. So you have hired servants, and then you had slaves. Hired servants were, again, paid. Slaves were not. So it's slightly better than a slave position where you'd actually earn a small wage. And most of the commentators think that the son believes he can work his way back eventually into his father's favor despite not actually being a son, so that he could pay his father back perhaps, and that things, even though he would never be a son again, that's what he would think, at least according to most of these commentators, that he would earn his way back into his father's favor. And so, but something very, very interesting happens here. So what he says is, I'm going to tell my father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. Here's the next question I want you to discuss. You'll notice that when he talks to the father in verses 20 through 22, he leaves out part of his little speech. He's got a pre-rehearsed speech. He leaves out part of it. What part does he leave out and why? 4 minutes. Discuss. Go.
He leaves out the part about bargaining with his dad about being his servant. So he's gone from this big plan to manipulate his dad. So when he sees his dad start to run to him, he realizes he doesn't have to bargain with him anymore. He really is still his son and still his father.
Okay, great. Yes, that is definitely. I have three potential down here. That is literally better than I wrote it. Perfect. He saw his father's compassion and sensed that amazingly he had even more in store. He remembered his father still loved him, so he dropped the make me a hired servant. Yes, sir. Right here.
I think he was coming to his father, and that was his plan in the beginning. But I think his father saw him, and then he was trying probably to get to the bargain part. But his father, he was so happy that he just didn't let him talk, finish his idea.
So he interrupts him.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Because his father was so happy about it.
Yeah, that is absolutely. That's number two there. So notice the language there. Again, I'm sorry. He says, so I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And then he was about to start his third line of his little speech. But the father said to his servants, bring quickly the best robe. Is this the idea? It's like he's going here and he's kind of making this apology and he's saying this. He's like, yeah, get the robe. Bring the ring. It's like, don't worry about it. It's the idea that he is so quick, he cuts him off. He doesn't even get to finish his thought. He didn't get to finish his thought. Maybe one other reason, possibly, right here.
That when he actually was confronted with his father, he was too ashamed to to make the request that he had thought about in his mind.
Boom, that is literally all three right there. He realized he didn't even stand to make any kind of deal at all, right? So when he goes to his father and his shame is juxtaposed, is contrasted with his father's love, he's like, I don't stand to ask for anything. I don't stand to make any kind of deal. The reality is it might very well be a combination of these things. We can't be exactly sure. Although, I think the way the text discusses it, I think the quickly one. Yes, sir. Microphone back here.
It's also possible that he understands that he's humble and he understands the relational damage that he's done.
That
he doesn't come and say, I squandered the stuff, but I damaged my relationship with God.
Fantastic point.
And I damaged my relationship with God.
You mentioned that when he is lamenting over there, he doesn't say anything about how I've hurt my dad. But now, maybe, to Ben's point, he's coming back and saying, he doesn't mention anything about, all of the squandering. He says, I've sinned against heaven and before you. And notice, the first sin is it against his father? I've sinned against heaven. Something's changed in this guy. He understands perspective now in a different way. And he's coming back to his father. So why does he leave it out and why? Great discussion there. Absolutely fantastic discussion. Verse 23, this is equally amazing. This father says, and bring the fattened calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. Oh, excuse me, into 22, apologize. Bring the best robe, quickly bring the best robe, put it on him, put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet. So the idea of the best robe, that would be reserved for an honored dignitary who is visiting. It may have even been the father's robe himself. The signet ring, that you are not just coming back in as a hired servant, you are coming back in with full family position and authority. That's what that signified. Shoes. Slaves didn't wear shoes, but sons wore shoes. And then the fattened calf here is very interesting because you didn't get a ton of meat in the Jewish diet. There wasn't a ton of meat, so it was a rare delicacy, but this would have been a huge deal. One commentator talks about it like this. The fattened calf specifically contrasted with, notice, when the older brother down here says, you never gave me a goat, right? A young goat. He knows that the fattened calf is reserved for something special. And it is. One commentator says it's a grain-fed animal raised for the express purpose of celebrating the presence of an honored guest. So this is particularly special. If some servant told you that your dad just slaughtered the fattened calf, you'd be like, what? Did I miss out on something? Did I miss an email? Why on earth did we just slaughter the fattened calf and I wasn't even aware of it? So it would have been huge. In verse 24 again, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And they began to celebrate. In rejecting his father and treating him as good as dead, he became dead to his father and now is restored to life. Okay? That's the picture here. Now again, I mentioned this earlier and I want to come back to it now. Unlike the lost parables before this, the son makes his own way home. Right? The coin doesn't find itself. The lost sheep doesn't find itself. Right? You have the shepherd going after it and the woman go after the coin. But this son makes his own way home. He's not sought out in the same way. We'll see, of course, the father does, run out to him. Why is that? Why is it the lost? Why does it say he was lost and now he's found? He wasn't lost. He came, he knew how to get back. He journeyed into the far country, remembered the road, and came back. Well, unlike the lost coin or the lost, so why? We don't have to discuss it, because I want to get to a couple of the other ones for sharing with your little micro group. Someone tell me, what do you think? Okay, the father knew that it was best for him.
I'm thinking too much about God.
Okay, so I guess just help me put together the, how is it that, so this comes at the end of, this is the third of three parables about lostness, except this person seems to know where he is at. In fact, he comes back himself. So how, in what way is he lost, and what does that mean?
Probably the
You said something, I'm sorry.
The father doesn't know he's not coming back.
Okay, the father doesn't know he's not coming back. So in what sense is he lost then?
In his wife.
Okay, explain further. Can you get him a mic?
Yeah, he's lost in his way, in his course of life, how his life is guided, steered, and directed. That's become derailed.
And which one's a more serious kind of lost? Right? Yeah. Is it being directionally lost, or being a coin under the cabinet, or is it someone who has literally lost their way, like this son? And that is why this comes at the end of these lost parables. It is a much more profound sense of lostness. And equally, the older son, as we're about to see, has his own profound sense of lostness. It doesn't end as well for him, though, at least in the parable, we're not told. He was lost not directionally, but because he had a hardened heart that was blind to the truth, and he had put his world together incorrectly. He didn't have the proper perspective. He was in his own little world. Now, the question that I want to discuss next is a profound one. So I want to give a little bit extra time for this question. Penal substitution. Penal substitution means substitution for punishment. Okay? Traditionally, evangelical Christians hold to a penal substitutionary theory of the atonement, meaning that God is a holy God. He cannot have any fellowship with sin. But he's a loving God, but he's also a just God. So he therefore has to punish sin. So you have the question, how can God show grace and he be just at the same time? The answer is in, of course, the person of Jesus, who, as a second Adam, represents us. He takes on the wrath of God. That is to say, he takes on the punishment for our sin in our place. He is a penal substitute for us, takes the wrath of God, so that God is, his justice comes down on Jesus. His grace then flows out of Jesus to us who are united with him by faith. But the idea is that some people will say, you know what, God didn't have to have a sacrifice. I mean, when you forgive somebody, do you require them to, like, do you punish them? You might, like, relationally punish them, maybe you shouldn't. But, I mean, do you require punishment when you forgive? You just forgive, don't you? If someone comes in you and says, confesses and repents and asks for forgiveness, you don't go punish them or say there's got to be punishment. Penal substitution deniers, which would include our Muslim friends, use this parable as an example of forgiveness and restoration with the Father without the need for any kind of punishment. Okay? Here's a question. Again, I'm going to give extra time for this. These are sketches. It is a charcoal sketch in this parable, but here's what I want you to discuss. Where do we see the motifs, the themes of incarnation, that is Jesus coming towards us, and the cross, the suffering and shame of the cross, in this parable? Where do we see the motifs, the themes of incarnation and the cross in this parable? I'll do a little bit longer on this one. Go. All right, time. All right. What did you come up with? How do we see charcoal sketches of incarnation and the cross in this parable? Jonah Bear.
Well, we kind of discussed that it was how the Son came back to the Father to ask for forgiveness and to plea, and how literally he was dead in his sin, and he lost his way. It was like a lost sheep, and now he's found. It's like he was reincarnated when he came back, and he was brought and shown that light. And then the Father, like, instantly responded. He's like, bring him the best robes, give him the ring, and it leads back to the cross, because it's, we were once dead in our sins, and we had filthy rags, but when we come to the cross, he cleansed us and gave us the robes of righteousness.
Okay, so we definitely have... So I don't want to say the Son is reincarnated, but I love the way you phrased it, that there is a passing from death to life that goes on, and that is pictured there. So that imagery you see throughout the rest of the New Testament, don't you? Even in Paul's letters, So more specifically, even from the side of the Father here, how do we see themes of either incarnation or the cross or both? This one right here. Susan, then Ben, then Claw.
This is not my brain. This is Ogden's brain, because he actually dealt with this about three chapters ago in a book that I've been reading. And the incarnation, he uses the example of the father running to his son. Because in the Jewish community, that was frowned upon. They did not do that. Dignified men. He would have picked up his robes.
Yes.
And he would have showed his legs, and he would have run to his son.
Yes.
Even though to us it doesn't seem like a big deal, but to them he could have. That was dishonorable.
Yes.
So he ran to his son.
Yeah.
That's
so,
a picture of the incarnation.
Fantastic observation there. You know, I was thinking about this, sharing this with some of the guys earlier this week. I think a lot of us, especially if you're older, it's kind of embarrassing for you to run now. And we're not even in that culture anymore, okay? But I mean, like, imagine you running in a department store or something. I mean, if you're sprinting after something with eagerness, not because you're trying to, you know, save your kid or something, but I mean, just the idea of running, even now, if you're an adult and you're in like your regular clothes and not playing soccer or something, it's kind of like, what are you doing? So the idea that someone would run back then was, to Susan's point, it was especially for an older man, an honorable man, he would have had to hike up his robe, you'd see his undergarments, and there he is running down the street. And people would have been shocked, would have been absolutely shocked. And it would have been shameful. It really would. You would not have done that. So don't miss the picture. The Father moving toward His Son who needs reconciliation. That's where we see a picture of the incarnation there. The Father moving towards the people who need reconciliation. He wasn't just sitting up in His state, tucked away on His huge piece of land, waiting for Him to say that, hey, your son's in the middle of the town and they're shaming him and this, that, and the other. No, he is looking for him, and then he is going out and pursuing him. So, particularly incarnation. And she kind of touched on it. Ben, what were you going to say before I... Yeah.
More about the cross.
Yeah,
angle.
Great, perfect.
So, about for the parallels to Jesus going on the cross and giving up life, what life did the Father give up? We'd already talked before about how he gave up his land and his possessions and shame within the city for having to do this for his son, and he still gets none of that back and gave his fattened calf to celebrate, and he has received nothing material in return, but has given it all out.
Exactly. That is exactly right. So Ben made a great point that it's not like the in verse 13 where it says that he took a journey of our country and there he squandered his property. He wasn't carrying like a big piece of land on his back, right? Like property. Like this had been liquidated, to Ben's Grady's point earlier, this is liquidated to say, so when he came back with nothing, like he didn't have anything to give back to him. Like it's gone. Father didn't have anything even if he paid him back in money, someone else now has that land. So there's nothing that he could bring back. More specifically, let me just ask us to consider this. You have the humiliation and shame of running, and then what does he do? What does he do though? Because when that son would have come back to the town, what do you think would have happened? What would have people thought and done? Oh, it would be awful. It would be accusation. It would be shame. And the father takes on shame himself to get in front of, to get in between the son returning and the people. He goes out and gets him on the road before anyone else gets there. And he says, go get the robe, go get the signet ring. Let's be clear, this person isn't coming back as a slave. I'm going to take the shame of going and standing in between, and I'm going to go out to him, and I'm going to clothe him with sonship instead. That's the picture that we see here. Here, get the mic.
The idea that he had been feeding pigs too, he was even ceremonial unclean, and if he would have touched his dad would have been unclean.
Oh yeah, great
and
point.
And so it's like, but he hugs him
and kisses him,
and in a sense, just like when Jesus touches and he doesn't become unclean himself, the person becomes clean. That's what the Father then does for the Son.
Wow, I never noticed that. I'm going to take a little note there. Okay, thank you so much. That's fantastic. Okay, we've got time for one more. Let's talk about briefly the older brother here. So the older son's in the field, and of course the younger brother comes back, and there's music and there's dancing because they weren't Baptist, and so they were angry. And if you like that, and so he says, "Look, you never fattened a calf for me. You never got a young goat for my friends and I to celebrate." So he's huffy about it, and you even see the language. So he's angry because he never got a celebration, and he kept the rules, right? He said, I did everything that you've asked me to do. I've not transgressed what you've asked. This son, that's the one who went and did, that's the one who ruined everything. And then the word look in verse 29 communicates almost exactly what it communicates in English. Look, these many years I've served you. When you start a sentence with look like that, what are you usually saying or expressing? Yeah, look here. Let me just tell you how it is. Okay, let me give you a little truth. Yeah, exactly. Let me get your attention here for a second. That's exactly right. Communicates about the same thing. So he's upset. He's upset. And the social shame of not going into your father's party. Again, the commentators and the people who know about the culture more than us tell us that this would be absolutely shameful, especially if other people are there. Your son's out in the field. You just slaughtered your fattened calf. You're having a party at your house. And he's like, no, I'm not coming. I'm not coming to the party for our family, for our son that's back. Last question I want us to discuss here. What does the parable show us about two equally devastating ways of being bad? What does the parable show us about two equally devastating ways of grieving the Father, being bad? Go. All right. What does the parable show us about two equally devastating ways of being, quote, bad? What'd y'all discuss?
Self-righteousness and just licentiousness.
Boom. Why is that relevant relative to who Jesus is talking to? Who's the audience of these parables? Yes. Chapter 15, verse 1. Now the tax collectors and sinners were all drawing near to him, and the Pharisees and scribes grumbled, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." Okay. So, this is the story of the self-righteous saint and the self-indulgent sinner, isn't it? The self-righteous saint. I've been here. I've done what you've asked. I've behaved, and I should get this now. Self-righteous saint. Self-indulgent sinner, younger brother. I'm going to go off. I'm going to spend a bunch of money. I'm going to live recklessly. Both people equally estranged from the Father. One looks a lot cleaner, doesn't it? One looks a lot better in this life. But Jesus' point, particularly in the context with the tax collectors and sinners, Pharisees and scribes, right there is, there's not just one way to be dirty and nasty. The outside of the cup can be clean and the inside can be disgusting. As we close here, let me just encourage you as a point of application. We usually tend to say, okay, this person, when we think of people in our heads usually we try to break this up into clean individuals. This person's a younger brother, this person's an older brother. What I want to suggest is all of us have a little bit of both in us. Okay? I think there are some people who's if you look at the narrative of their life, might be characterized and is likely characterized by one or the other. That's true. But I think everyone can find some of both brothers in them. So here's my challenge, just as an application as we close. This week, hopefully today, write down one way that you tend to be the older brother and one way that you tend to be the younger brother. Even if it's very small, I hope no one is writing down, well, I go spend all of our family's money on online gambling sites. If you say, well, I don't have anything like that to write down, I promise you still do something that can identify with the younger brother. I promise that you can find that. I promise. How does the lavish grace of God displayed in this parable address those specific tendencies? And what small practical step can you take this week to help address those tendencies? Maybe it's a sticky note on your monitor at work. Maybe it's having a reminder on your phone to do X, Y, or Z. And then finally, who will you tell so that they can follow up with you and see how it went? So So write down one way you tend to be the older brother and one way you intend to be the younger brother. How does the lavish grace of God displayed in this parable address those tendencies? And what small practical step can you take to help address those tendencies? And who will you tell so they can follow up with you and see how it went? Okay. Let's close in prayer, please. Father, we sit here and marvel at a picture of our shame being covered. Not just our guilt, but our shame being covered and being restored to sonship, to children of God. That we were lost and now we're in Christ, that we're found. That we were what we were delivered from and delivered to. And Father, we pray that you would help us search our own hearts, because this is for these two ways to be estranged from you. The self-indulgent sinner and the self-righteous saint, Father, help us search our hearts by the Spirit. Deal with us, Father. Help us examine ourselves truly and honestly. And as soon as we do that, stare at the grace of God displayed in the cross and the Son of God. And pray that you would help transform our hearts through these small applications, these small steps, and pray that this wouldn't be a Sunday school that just everyone walks out and forgets, but Father, that you would impress it upon our hearts to be about the work of reflecting on these things and doing the work of God. In your Son's name we pray. Amen.